Thank you, Demetrius Pogo. What is your name?
Domati. Yeah,
Pogo.
Remember, I do news here.
And then there's
Saturdays.
Generic brand. Griffin, I won't even try and say your last name. Who are you guys?
I like my new nickname.
What is that?
You just said generic brand?
Yeah, that's not nice. I shouldn't say that because you're super special and awesome, Joe.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, welcome back.
Welcome
back.
Yeah.
And yet, for some reason, they didn't miss me.
So we missed you, Jim.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I deserve that. So this is John Williams, heard weekdays from 1 to 3. And if you're literally new to this Saturday's show in the last few weeks, I've been gone, what with Northwestern football and Brenda and I doing a little traveling. Last weekend, we were in Madison for a friend's wedding, her daughter's wedding. And so we've just been kind of traveling a little bit. But it's good to be back in the Allstate Skyline studio on a Saturday morning with you all. And let's see, so tonight is when we set the clocks back 1 hour, and I have a few questions about that. I thought I saw a news story, I couldn't find it today, that this may be, that soon we may be eliminating this business of setting the clocks forward and back. And we'll talk to an expert about that, a guy who's actually written a book on the topic. He's really pleasant, and it's a surprising conversation after 10:30. You know, on a serious note about all of that, when you make it darker earlier, it makes it more dangerous or difficult for school children, school buses, and all of us. I don't think that's what's going on here right now. But this spate of school bus accidents and kids being hit is off the charts. I don't know what's going on out there. I know we're more distracted these days, and it is getting darker earlier, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, boy, it's all of a sudden come in numbers right now, and so be careful as you're driving about. Listen, having celebrated the fact that I'm going to be back now with my Saturday show, I'm going to have to take next Saturday off. Because next Saturday, I'm going to be at the Elgin Community College Blizzard Theater with Teddy Roosevelt. So the much-awaited Teddy Roosevelt show is next Saturday. And we'll be on stage at 10:30. There are still some tickets left to that. I'm happy that you still get an opportunity to buy tickets. Honestly, I'm a little discouraged that it hasn't completely sold out, though it has nearly so. But I'm telling you, this is my little civic mission in life to get more people to celebrate these great presidents, Thomas Jefferson and Teddy Roosevelt. And I know you will enjoy the show if you get to see it. In fact, Doris Kearns Goodwin's new book is out. It's called Leadership in Turbulent Times, and in it she profiles four presidents, and one of them is Teddy Roosevelt. So I've been reading the book for that reason, and then I actually talked to her the other day a little bit about Teddy coming to Chicago. And the close of our conversation, because I was telling her about how I get to interview him on stage, towards the close of our conversation, she and I had this exchange.
I'm going to be on stage the Saturday after the election with Teddy Roosevelt. If you were there, if you had a chance to ask Teddy a question or two, and I'm not sure he'd appreciate my calling him Teddy, what?
I know, I do too.
What should I ask him?
I think the main thing to understand about Teddy right now is I think he would be the best suited of all of them to come back and deal with us today, because he understood how the Industrial Revolution had really made people in the rural areas feel anxious from the cities. It made workers feel separated from the capitalists. But he called for a square deal, and he understood the importance of words. You know, he said there's certain words that are weasel words that don't mean anything. And he when he went around the country on that train, what he was trying to do was to make people feel that they weren't separated. He said the rock of democracy would founder when people in different sections and regions and classes and parties begin to feel that they are the other rather than common American citizens. I'd say bring him back and tell him to run in 2020.
Now, I'm a sarsaparilla man myself. I was accused by a newspaper in 1912 of being publicly drunk. It was a labor newspaper, and the editor got a little out of hand during the Bull Moose campaign, and he said, "This Roosevelt, everyone agrees, is often seen drunk publicly." And so I sued the newspaper. And the poor editor just wanted to drop it. I wouldn't let him. And so at $40,000 expense, which would be $500,000 in your time, I assembled this team of everybody who ever knew me. And we came up to Wisconsin. And we had a trial. And they all said, "I've never seen Mr. Roosevelt drink." I made a list of every alcoholic beverage I had ever consumed. Every one, an autobiography of Drake. Yes, you should try this. And after all these people gave their depositions, and I remember one of them was asked, well, is Mr. Roosevelt publicly drunk? And he said, no, he just looks like he's drunk. But after all this, the judge was just this weary little fellow. He just wanted to get it over with. And he said, I think that all of the character witnesses that you have brought in, Mr. Roosevelt, have adequately proved that this was an irresponsible charge made by this newspaper. Can we stop? And I said, no. I want to be on the witness stand myself, and I'm going to tell you every drink that I have ever consumed and where. And I gave a 4-hour deposition. So it's all over now, and the judge is just, he's a spent man, as weary as can be. And he finally said, I'm summarily deciding for you, the plaintiff. Now it's time for damages. We understand that you have spent $40,000 on this trial. You're entitled to relief. I said, what's the minimal fine? The judge said, 6 cents. I said, that's the fine. Because I didn't want to make this about money, of course. That would be silly. But Alice drank. Because she knew that I didn't.
Teddy Roosevelt telling a long story there, essentially about his daughter Alice, who we could do 2 hours on. He spent a few minutes that day. Again, next Saturday, right about this time, 10:30, we'll be on stage at the Elgin Community College. Get your tickets at WGNradio.com/events. By the way, I'm also reading, besides Doris Kern Goodwin's book, Leadership, which is really nice. It's easy. It's a page-turner. And if you aren't especially interested in Franklin Delano Roosevelt or Johnson, then you can skip to Lincoln or TR. Those are the four she profiles. But the other two books I'm reading are Big Game by Mark Leibovich, and it's about the NFL right now. Everything from Colin Kaepernick to helmets and concussions. And it's just fascinating. It's really interesting. And Powerball, which by Rob Nyer is a book about Major League Baseball right now. I'm actually thinking, Joe, of buying a bunch of copies of Powerball, the baseball book by Nyer, and giving it to everybody at the station in sports. Because it's not because you guys know enough about sports, but I just think you all would so enjoy it. Here's what he did. He went to a baseball game last year that wasn't all that consequential. I think it was the Oakland A's playing somebody. It wasn't an important or critical game. It was midseason, whatever. He tells you the story of that baseball game, that single baseball game, over about 350 pages. The strategies, the players, the history of the teams in the game, and the direction it's taking. So if they do a pinch hitter, why do we do pinch hitters now? He talks about, for instance, how if a power hitter is up, and power hitter is a lot of people these days, they put that shift on where there's three people on one side of second base, usually on the right side. How much more often that happens, how effective it is. How much it happens to Anthony Rizzo, and why doesn't Rizzo bunt more often down the third baseline? He said that since they've been doing the shift on Rizzo, he's bunted 14 times down third base. And in the 14 attempts, you know how often he's gotten on? Anyone? Bueller?
13.
You'd think, right? 7. But, I mean, he's batting .500 when they shift, and he says, fine, I'll just push it down the left side. So anyway, the book just goes on and on like that. A lot of fun anecdotes and interesting statistics, but it also talks about the money and the game. And if you're a baseball fan, I can heartily recommend that one as well. So act surprised, Joe, at Christmas when I give you Powerball, if you don't already have it, by Rob Nyer.
I don't. I'm a big fan of Rob Nyer, though.
I don't know him at all.
He used to be on MLB Network a lot, and I believe he's a commissioner of some smaller baseball league right now.
He is. I don't remember it exactly, but yeah, I was kind of reading his biography.
I want to say a collegiate wooden bat league, but yeah.
Yes, it is. It is a college league. It is a collegiate league, like the Appalachian or the New York League or something like that. So
no, he's full of wisdom and knowledge, and he does a good job of not making it solely on the analytics and not making it totally all about numbers. He does a good job of spreading all that knowledge aside and putting it in simpler terms, too. So, yeah, I haven't read it. I honestly haven't heard of it. I totally would read this, though.
Okay, well, then don't buy it. I'm going to get just hold on until December, okay?
Okay.
So Halloween was this week. Hope you had a good one. So let's play the Jimmy Kimmel clip here briefly. Bill and Wendy did a little bit of this the other day, and we touched on it on my show ever so briefly. I want your call right now or text at 312-981-7200 and tell me if you think this is fun.
Once again this year, we asked parents to tell their kids they ate all their candy. This is our eighth year doing this, and once again, you really answered the call. We got over 1,000 videos. We went through all of them. We narrowed it down.
I ate all of your Halloween candy last night.
I'm so disappointed at you.
You're not mad I ate all your candy?
I'm not mad at all. Mm-hmm. I'll never be mad at you because you're my mom.
You're too sweet. It's gross.
I hate your mommy!
Did you say you hate your mommy?
Yes! You hate my candy! No one's coming in! Unless they have all my candy!
You get the idea, right? So every year, Jimmy Kimmel tells you to hide the kids' candy, tell them that you ate it all, and then videotape the reaction and send it in. So the news click over the weekend at WGNradio.com and on my Facebook page, I'm WGN King John, is asking you, do you think that's really funny and it's the kids will be fine, or it's really funny but you shouldn't do that, that's way too mean to a kid, or it's not even funny at all? Joe, the news click at WGNradio.com, if you scroll down a little bit, you'll see it there. It says, we're asking you if you think that Jimmy Kimmel bit is funny. And the kids can handle it. It's funny, but you shouldn't do that to the kids. It's way too mean, or it's not funny at all. I'm so disappointed in our listeners. 50% are saying it's not funny. 38% are saying it's funny, but you shouldn't do that to the kids. And 11% and me, I'm saying it's funny and the kids can handle it. Once again, find myself in the minority on a major American issue. What did you want to say? Stephanie, you're on WGN Radio. Hi.
Hi, how are you, John?
Good, you're on the air. What's up?
I think it's really cruel. It's mean. I don't think it's funny. I had a friend that did that to her three daughters, and the response she got from her three daughters were, I hate you, Mommy. You're the worst mom ever. I hate you. Like, why would you want to do something that elicits that kind of response from your children? Why would you want to make your children cry for your enjoyment? I just don't think it's funny.
I wouldn't do it either. But when I see these kids, I think if that's the kind of conniption you're throwing over lost candy, then maybe this is a lesson that you were all going to benefit from. I think those families will heal pretty quickly. But I don't know. It's been a while, and I never did that. Stephanie, what did your friend say happened afterwards? Like when she gave the candy back to the kids, was it cool, or were they still a little resentful, you know?
Oh, they were resentful. Yeah. I mean, she showed me the video. She took a video of it and showed me. I mean, the looks that these girls gave to their mom was death looks.
Well,
they were really angry at her.
Did she regret
No,
it?
She thought it was really funny. She thought it was really funny. And I said, I think you're really mean.
Yeah,
I would never do that to my kids.
I'm really glad you're listening. Thanks, Stephanie.
Thanks, John.
Yeah, have a good day. Let's go to Joanne. You're on WGN. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, it's Joanne.
Hi, you're on the air.
I think it's absolutely ridiculous that this is even a question. You know, no, would I do that? No, I'm not a fan of teasing, but the kids can handle this. People need to learn to be resilient. We're all too wimpy now with our kids and, you know, all worried about every little thing that's going to upset them. I could tell you a story of something my father did when I was little. Now I'm 60 years old, and I lived through it. I found a rabbit in a field, and I was allowed to bring the rabbit home. Little did I know he was fattening it up. And one day I came home from school, and it was roasted on the table, and he was eating it. And guess what? I'm not traumatized. He just came from a different generation.
Ooh.
I understand it. Kids need to be strong.
But now I'm traumatized.
I have to teach them to be strong, to worry about every little baby thing like this.
Now I have to deal with that. Oh, my God. That sounds worse than a Halloween
candy. Oh, my God.
Candy.
He was just from the old world, and
he
didn't think anything of it.
How about that? I'm glad you're listening too, Joanne. Thank you for the phone call.
I got over it.
Okay. Let's go from you to Tom. Or is it Tony? Tony.
It's Tony.
Hi,
Good
Tony.
Morning.
Hey.
I thought it was absolutely hilarious. It was the last thing I did before I went to bed because I wanted to go to bed on a note of laughter. Now I have two grandsons, and I don't think I would ever do that. But in and of itself, I thought it was just a crazy funny. I thought it was hilarious. The things the kids came up with and their comments about, oh, Jimmy Kimmel, you showed us these videos. It made me laugh.
That's Tony.
I agree.
Thank you, Tony.
I think it's funny, but there is some dissonance in everyone saying that they like it, also saying they would never do it. Right? Doesn't that strike
you as a little funny? It's somebody else's train wreck.
Like, yes, it's horrible, but it's funny. I kind of agree.
You know, it's lost on the radio, though, Griff. You and I are watching it as video in the studio and in our office, and that is the kids are adorable. I mean, one of the pleasures of watching this is if it's been a long time since you've had little kids in pajamas running around your house being four, it's just really sweet to see. And they are dramatic. Oh, my God. So that's part of the video that's a little lost on the radio. Anne says on line one, hey, these kids need to be taught a lesson. Okay. Thank you, Domati. This is John Williams. We have a guest we'll go to and give me 60 seconds here. I believe what I've been doing is called electioneering. It's where you stand outside the place where people go to vote and you tell them what to do. Because during the news, I was able to move the needle. When we asked you if you thought the Jimmy Kimmel stunt on TV where he asked you to tell your kids you ate their Halloween candy, video it and send it to them, 50% of you had said that's not funny. And only 11% of you had said that it is funny and the kids can handle it. But now we've gone from 11% to 19% of you agree with me that it's funny and the kids can handle it. So I got that going for me. Although I don't think all of the texters agree. What are you reading, Griffin?
It's split pretty down the middle because the callers were all mostly on your side, with the one exception, I think. And the texters overwhelmingly disagree.
they don't like it.
But, for example, one says, to be happy that your kids are miserable, sick, sick, sick.
Yeah.
Psycho. Sadism 101.
Wow.
Appalling. Sign of mental illness.
Wow. Really?
Something to think about.
Yeah.
Wrong, disgusting. Kids should not be sacrificed as fodder for parents hoping for a millisecond of fame.
I think that is definitely happening here.
That's definitely true.
I'm not endorsing that.
That's true.
In fact, I've completely changed my mind. It's
you're not endorsing. That is what I mean. You could use different words.
Really, that I say I'm not endorsing it, but my actions are, I guess I'm endorsing it.
I'm not endorsing it. It's fantastic. What? What do you mean?
All right. Stop talking then.
Yeah.
It's 10:39, so we set our clocks back tonight. You know, the country, maybe world's foremost authority on this topic of daylight saving is the guy who wrote the book Seize the Daylight, the curious and contentious story of daylight saving time. There's no S after saving. Daylight saving time. His name is David Perreault, and he joins us again on WGN Radio. David, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Good. How are you, John?
I'm doing real well. Did I find you in Boston again, sir?
Yes, I am. That's where I am.
Did I read somewhere, David, that in fact it's possible we're going to eliminate setting the clocks forward and back? Is that on the horizon?
Well, there's some states that are looking into it. The current law allows any state to either have the regular daylight saving time set up, which most states have, or to have year-round standard time. Only two states have year-round standard time now: Hawaii, which is near the equator, and the sunrises and sunsets don't change very much over the year, and Arizona, where it's so hot in the summer, the last thing they want is more daylight. They want less daylight. They go outdoors after the sun goes down. But the other 48 states have the standard period. But each state could choose to change that.
I still, you know, I got to tell you, I'm still a little mystified by that, because you can do whatever you want to the clock. You're not going to change the amount of daylight that you have, right?
That's exactly right. What it really does, since most people are clock-oriented because they have a job or other reasons, or they're going to school, or the things that are based on the clock, by having daylight saving time in this spring, summer, and fall, it allows us to essentially move an hour of daylight from the morning, where a lot of people sleep through it, or at least it's not as usable, to the evening when it's more available to most people. So most people feel that's a pretty good pretty good trade-off in for most of the year. Now, if you try to do that in the winter by having year-round daylight saving time, you would get very dark and cold winter mornings, and people would have to go to work in the dark and go to send their kids to school in the dark, and that's why we don't have it in the winter right now.
But, I mean, that's a little subjective, isn't it? I mean, maybe I would prefer that it get darker in the evening rather than wake up to it in the morning. You know, one way or another, it's you're only going to have so many hours of daylight, and the question is, where do you all want to... Where do you want the clock to be set?
Obviously, there are people that like the morning daylight. But when they've looked into it, they found that most people prefer the daylight in the evening in the spring and summer. When they come home from work or school and they have an extra hour of daylight, they find that extra hour more usable than if they had an extra hour of daylight, say, 6 to 7 a.m. So, but some people love that morning daylight. It's not a yes or no, but it's in opinion. But for the most part, most people prefer to have it in the evening as long as you don't get very dark mornings.
Yeah, right. Did we originally do this to accommodate farmers or something like that?
Actually, that's a myth. That's completely wrong.
Oh.
The farmers have always been, from the very beginning of using daylight saving time, 100 years ago, until the present, they've always been the major group against daylight saving time. And the reason they're against daylight saving time is that other people are oriented to the clock and they move forward when the daylight saving time moves the clock forward. But farmers generally have to go by the sun. So while everybody else can move forward, they can't. And you might say, well, so what? They can just do whatever they want. But they have to interact with everybody else. They have to bring products to market. They have to deal with outside businesses and so on. And so the farmers haven't liked it. Now, what's happened recently is that in places like the U.S. where farmers have modern equipment and modern techniques, they're not as dependent on the sun as they used to be, so they're not as much against daylight saving time as they were. But around the world, in other places where farmers have less modern equipment, they're still the strongest voice against daylight saving.
Well, do other countries do this?
It's in 70 countries about right now, all over the world, and including the Southern Hemisphere. You don't think of it in Australia, New Zealand, places like that. They have daylight saving time, but they have it in their summer, which is our winter.
I wonder if, you know, we have this rash of school bus accidents or school children accidents where cars are running into them. I wonder if we were going to try and make that as safe as possible for the kids, if we should take this into consideration. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, we did try year-round daylight saving time in the 1970s when there was an energy crisis in the country. And year-round daylight saving time was put in by the federal government for 2 years. Well, what happened is the first winter, when they had daylight saving time in the winter and they had darker mornings, they found a lot of people didn't like, a lot of people were afraid to send their kids to school, wait on the side of a road or go through the streets of a dark city. And they found that there was some, every time there was a report of a accident or a death of a child on the school, it was national news. And so even though that had been put in for 2 years, it wound up being cut back to 1 year because it was so disliked in the winter. And so that's the problem with year-round daylight saving time, which is being proposed around the country in some states, but that's the negative, that you have very dark mornings in the winter.
Well, if we wanted the kids to, when they get off the school bus, it to be as bright as possible, then it's better what we're doing now, right?
Correct.
But the downside is that they may be waiting in the morning for a bus, and it's going to be darker now.
No. What I'm talking about is having daylight saving time in the winter, you would have darker mornings. If you have daylight saving time in the summer or the spring and the fall, because there's a lot more light in that time, you still have light in the morning and light in the evening. You just have more light in the evening. But you don't have dark mornings. But when you have daylight saving time in the winter, that's when you get dark mornings. I was involved with the last extension of daylight saving time with the congressman who passed that bill. And the original plan was to have it extend to the end of November. And we found that if you went even that far, not even December or January, you got into very dark mornings in some parts of the country. And so that's why daylight saving time only goes to the first week in November, because we didn't want to go too late to have too many dark mornings.
So as you understand it, then it's going to stay the same. No, I mean, Illinois could, I guess there's no federal mandate. Illinois, Indiana, we could all do whatever we want.
Now, Florida has passed a law to try to get year-round daylight saving time. As I said, that's not really an option under the present federal law, but they could try to change the federal law that gives them that option. California is having a referendum on having year-round something, and they're not even sure if they want to have year-round standard time or year-round daylight time. If you had year-round standard time, you would lose the benefit of the nice, long, lighted evenings in the middle of the summer. So I tend to think that the current system is a pretty good system. We have 8 months of daylight saving time, but in the darkest 4 months, from November through early March, we have standard time, so we don't get too dark mornings. And that's the system we have now. But it might change.
You know, one other thing, though, I've never really understood. I guess, does that mean that tonight, when it gets to be 2 a.m. tomorrow morning, someone's going to say, no, it's really 1 a.m. So suppose your shift ended at 2 a.m. They go, now it's 1 a.m. There will be 25 hours in this day, 25 work hours. And so somebody has to work an extra hour, right?
Right. Well, that's always been an issue for overnight workers. And, of course, one could say that then they have an hour less that they work in March when we go to daylight saving time. And so, therefore, and we move the clocks forward, so it balances out in the long run. So
yeah,
it is
so.
True that if you work at 2 a.m., and in November, you have to work an extra hour, but then in March, you have to work one less hour, and it balances out.
Right. I have a friend at this radio station who's going to be on the air at 2 o'clock tomorrow morning, and he's going to have to do that hour over again, and his consolation will be that in the spring, he'll get to leap forward 1 hour, so I guess it'll all even out in the long run. Got it.
That's right.
Dr. David Perot, he's the author of the book on this topic. If you ever need any detail, he is the authority. Seize the Daylight, the Curious and Contentious Story of Daylight Saving Time. It's not just nice to talk to you again, David. Thanks for joining us. I'll talk to you next year.
Okay, well, happy to do it.
It's his life's work, and he's highly sought after once a year. Maybe twice. Maybe we'll have him on in the spring. It's 10:49. More than $284 million has been raised for the Illinois governor's race. $284 million for the race between Rauner and Pritzker. More than the $280 million spent in 2010 in the California run-up. That was the record. But now Illinois has it. Good job, Illinois! USA Today, today. My brother actually pointed this out to me. He's in Colorado. He was just reading about it. He doesn't know these people. He said, what's going on there? And I said, I don't know. Polls suggest that J.B. Pritzker, the USA Today says, the heir to the Hyatt hotel chain, who Forbes estimates has a net worth of $3.2 billion, J.B. Pritzker will coast to victory over the incumbent Bruce Rauner. That's what the USA Today is predicting, and all the polls are showing that he's got about a 20-point spread. Hey, vote for whoever you want. The amount of campaign cash raised in Illinois is even more astounding when you consider that California has a population of 37 million people in 2010 when they set the record, three times what we have today. So we are now just a little bit ahead of California in raising $284 million for this governor's race. We did so with one-third of the people that they had in California. Pritzker has raised $175 million, nearly all of it from his own pocket. Boy, you know you've got a lot of money. this is either the bane or the celebration of capitalism, but you have a heaven, $175 million of your own dollars to put in to a race whose outcome at the beginning wasn't known for a job that no sensible person could want. Good grief. Rauner, the former private equity investor with a net worth he once estimated at about $500 million, has collected more than $79 million for his reelection bid. Another $29 million has been raised by primary challengers, the Conservative Party, and the Libertarian Party nominees and independent groups. Pritzker says he's outspending the governor. JB says he's outspending the governor by the same amount that the governor outspent Pat Quinn 4 years ago. He acknowledges the sum is enormous, but Pritzker said it would be political malpractice to unilaterally disarm. He says, look, Rauner outspent his opponent 2-1 in 2014. Now he's complaining about it, right? Rauner has spent $50 million of his own money for the 2018 campaign. The governor has spent more than $72 million on reelection efforts as of September 30th. Those are different numbers, but I presume one of them goes back to that race against Jeannie Ives. Remember, the governor escaped a primary challenge from Representative Jeannie Ives with a narrow victory and has not contributed any more to his campaign after dropping the $50 million. Rauner says he's put a huge fraction of his fortune into the campaign. I don't know if that's supposed to be a lot or not a lot, because it's still, the word fraction makes it sound like not a lot. But here's what Bruce Rauner told the USA Today. My grandparents were dairy farmers. They lived in a trailer. I did not inherit any money. I've worked hard, I've done well, and I'm proud of it. But I don't have Pritzker's wealth. I don't have anywhere close to it. Okay, maybe you don't, but wow, you still put in $50 million. Rauner has aired attack ads pointing out that Pritzker's family disconnected the toilets from one of their Chicago mansions so it could be deemed uninhabitable while it was under renovation. The move saved Pritzker about $330,000 in taxes. The next sentence is this, and I don't think I knew this. Pritzker paid the money to Cook County, that $330,000, after an inspector general report leaked to the news media slammed the tactic as a scheme to defraud. So this says that he actually gave that money back. It's interesting, though, when, you know, you sort of step back, we all get so immersed in it, and then you read what a national publication or somebody from out of state is saying about us, and they all just can't get their head around, A, how much money we're spending, and then they point to some of the political tactics that the two of them are using. And Rauner is accusing JB of being a trust fund baby. He never worked that hard, et cetera, et cetera. All I know is, if my dad and mom had a lot of money and dad spent $170 million to be governor before I got my hands on it, I would be a little upset with that.
Yeah, yeah, I understand that. Or say you were someone who was qualified to be governor and had a lot of good ideas and knew how to work with people, but you didn't have this much money. It would be a shame if you weren't able to run because you don't have so much money.
So here's my solution to that. Tell me if you think this is a good idea. I've long said this. You should not be able to spend on a campaign for a job more than the job pays. So what's the governor's job pay? $200,000? That should be the most that you can put in.
You know, immediately senators would be like, okay, our salary is now $300 million a year.
Okay, well then that would kind of backfire, wouldn't it? It's 10:57. We've got the latest from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom from Doma T. Pongo coming up next on WGN. Thank you, Doma T. This is John Williams. You can hear me weekdays from 1 to 3 here on WGN Radio, right up to the show with Ro Khan and Anna DeVlantis. Good to be back on a Saturday morning. Next Saturday, I'll be taking the day off again, but I'm working. We'll be on stage with Teddy Roosevelt at Elgin Community College, our annual conversation with the president. I think your family will have fun if you come. You can get tickets at WGNradio.com/events. Half hour from now, Dome, we'll do what we usually do on Saturdays when I'm here, and that is we'll all kick around some things on a segment we call the Vibe Segment. What's going on in pop culture a little bit and other arenas, and we'll ask a question and score it. I'll explain a little later on, but it leads me to this question just real quick. Is there a show that you guys are really watching and loving right now? Because I was thinking about asking you to give me your 1 to 100 score on The Haunting of Hill House. I don't know if you guys have watched that. I don't even know. Domi, do you have TV? Do you watch TV at your place?
I do not have a television device.
Yeah, right.
Well, actually, I do have a TV, but I use Kindle Fire, Fire Stick, and all that type of stuff.
So is there a show you're really digging these days?
Netflix, Big Mouth.
Okay. Wow, you watch that, huh?
I love Big Mouth. Are you a fan, Joe?
I watched it. I can't say I'm a big fan, but I do watch it.
Yes. So Big Mouth is a show about, it's a cartoon, but it's an adult cartoon about kids going through puberty. And it is very Beavis and Butthead type humor, but it's also kind of educational. There's a feminist character who's like 10 years old, and it's entertaining. It's a weird show. It's funny. It's kind of smart. I like it.
It's an easy watch. You don't have to overthink anything, really.
At all. You can start right from the middle.
Yeah, but then you're watching a cartoon. What do you think?
It is a cartoon.
It is a cartoon.
I love Big Mouth. It comes from Nick Kroll, and John Mulaney is also one of the main voices. So.
Oh, I love Nick Kroll.
I'm obsessed with both of them. So, so I watched. I was not that interested in the show, how it looked, but when I heard they were involved, I was like, I got to watch. And the both seasons are good.
When we do the segment, let's add that, right? We'll all be rating things, but I'll also ask you guys to at least, because the problem is, somebody throws out a show, we all haven't seen it, and then it doesn't work. But at least advocate for your show. So everybody pick a show that you would throw out there to say, if you're looking for something to get into, what would you recommend?
And I've got a show. I'm going to tweak mine a little bit. I'm going to advocate for a type of genre, a show genre. So be looking out for that. Now, I think you guys will follow me here.
All right, Dome. That's in about a half an hour. Listen, we do this podcast on Thursdays called The Mincing Rascals, and then we post it usually around 5 o'clock on Thursday evenings. We broadcast part of it Saturday mornings when I'm here on WGN Radio. It features our Steve Bertrand in the newsroom, Justin Kaufman and Patty Vasquez usually join us. And from the Chicago Tribune, it's Scott Stantis, the editorial cartoonist, and Eric Zorn. The gang today is talking a little bit about birthright citizenship. Axios reporters brought the topic up to the president, and he said, we ought to end it. That means he, with his pen, wants to change the 14th Amendment. That got our Patty Vasquez to say,
well, it's fascinating how many people never even considered the 14th Amendment until he told them to.
I know. I'm reading my Constitution again. And the funny thing
is, I handed it out for trick-or-treats.
There it is.
Did you? Oh, good.
That would have been so
next
good.
Year.
Those poor kids.
I thought of it this morning.
I know.
Poor kids walking away from the house says, don't go there.
No. Brian said on Twitter that he handed out freshly made egg salad sandwiches.
No. Well, no, my son asked the kids. My son asked kids when they came to the door, he said, did your parents vote? And if they haven't, tell them they should. So that's why I thought of the Constitution. I said I should have given him a stack of Constitution to hand out. So my apologies, John. I cut you off with
Actually, Scott, you started this whole conversation with your cartoon. What's your thought right now?
An executive order cannot shoot down the 14th Amendment. I mean, no matter how much he and his minions may hope.
A lot of people say it can.
No, they don't, though.
Actually,
it can't.
A lot of people don't even do that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
No, they're going to go through. And here's the nasty, dark side of this story. Let's assume for a moment he does issue this executive order, and the federal government and the institutions that it affects start implementing it.
They'd get a quick injunction shooting it down, don't
you think?
There'd
be some sort of
One would think, but it still gets implemented for a short period of time, and in that period of time, there's a lot of misery.
Well, there are a couple of things that need to be said about this. One is that if you come here and have a child, you do not, I mean, people talk about anchor babies, but your child becomes a citizen, you do not have protections if you are unauthorized in this country. So whether you have a child or not, that doesn't give you any protection. That's a myth that's out there. Number two is, you know, you can argue that it's a little strange that someone can fly in here from China and have deliberately fly in when they're about ready to give birth and have a child who's then a U.S. citizen and then fly home.
That's a gift to the kid.
There's some absurdity to that, but you have to look at what the alternative is to that, which is that you would have, and there are countries that don't grant birthright citizenship, mm-hmm. and so you have people who are generations of stateless people who are not full citizens living in your country, and I think that is far worse than whatever horrible thing that people think is the byproduct of birthright citizenship. You want people to be U.S. citizens. I think that when you look at how these people perform professionally, socially, and so on, as they grow up, they become Americans and they become contributors to our society. I don't see the big downside that people are talking about with birthright citizenship.
I don't either, Eric. You know, I've been living my life in this country for almost 59 years now, and it hasn't been a problem for me. Hasn't been an issue for me. I didn't know
that's your white privilege.
And I think that's a good point, though, about white. And I don't mean white privilege, but the idea that we talk about this as though it's just a political football or pinata or, you know, what we should consider. I mean, like, and also, as Scott mentioned, this is something that could be implemented and affect people fundamentally. So think of all those people who are terrified and wondering what their status is and what's going to happen tomorrow.
And I have to have full disclosure here. 3 of my 4 grandparents were immigrants to this country. Went through Ellis Island. 2 of them married American citizens. I'm really adamant and very passionate about immigration and immigrant rights and immigrant and how powerful and positive a force it is in the United States. It always has been.
My great-grandparents didn't speak English. They spoke French.
And by the way, Eric, I'm now feeling a little defensive about you saying that I have white privilege. I know I have white privilege because I'm a white guy and I have a comfortable life.
I have it too.
I'm trying to figure out who is harmed. That's my point. Who is harmed by the status quo?
Well, I mean, I guess a lot of people point to services and money. They look at it as financial.
Unemployment is low.
I understand. I'm not telling you what I think. I'm just reading through my Facebook and social media feeds and seeing people who are outraged by the amount of money, the texts that I get. You know, John, we get these texts from
trust
listeners.
Me, I know.
I got to tell you, I'm really conflicted about this conversation because I think it does deserve a serious consideration, and I think 275,000 is a big number. But it doesn't. It's not going to happen when we're falling for it. This is what he's doing. He's not going to issue an executive order. He's not going to issue a 10% tax cut for the middle class. He's not going to change the definition of transgender.
And he's not
all of this stuff.
And he's not going to send those troops to the border.
Hey, no,
I guarantee
all
that.
Of this, it's
next
all
Wednesday,
done.
Everything changes.
It's like, all made up.
Back to attacking Mueller.
For the election.
I understand, and I agree with you. And I also, like I said a moment ago, there are people who this affects, and they are scared. And those, I mean, like, we can argue about it, not want to talk about it, because it just draws more attention and gives him what he wants. And ultimately,
yeah,
it's not going to ease their concerns.
But what are we supposed to do about these words by the president? I mean, it's not a one-off. He's repeating them at rallies.
I think we should say that it betrays an absolute ignorance of the Constitution, and it's not going to happen.
Congress has never passed a law requiring birthright citizenship for illegal aliens, and the Constitution does not, I say that to the media, does not require it. Read it. Because illegal aliens are not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States.
And then say, meanwhile,
or
in sports.
Or willful ignorance.
And then drop the mic.
With that.
Well, I'll give you another. This kind of segues into that, Steve. Another topic that's really animated our listeners here at the radio station, and you two know this, the topic of the president's strident language itself. Did he somehow motivate the letter bomber, Cesar Sayoc? Why are you laughing now? I'm not even done with my introduction of this thought.
I'm sorry.
And though he evidently was angry at President Trump, that Robert Bowers guy, somehow motivated by Trump's anti-immigration language, should we hold the president somewhat responsible for the acts of some of these people?
I think so. I think that he has created a climate with his rhetoric. Obviously, he's not ordering people to go out and commit these heinous acts, but they are encouraged by his rhetoric. He has set a tone in this country that makes these things more thinkable, more likely to happen. Yeah, I think that he has failed miserably yet again, and in this area of being a uniting force in the aftermath of something that's horrible. And, turning on a dime and trying to blame the media for the temperature in this country, it's reckless, it's obscene, it's absurd, it's dangerous. Yeah, my answer is yes.
The synagogue, the guy who shot up the synagogue was upset about the the fact that the synagogue was a sponsor of this program that would bring in immigrants, right? Is that part of it?
Yeah.
Right? And so it comes while the president is claiming about this invasion, this infestation, this smallpox-carrying caravan.
And some people believe that that is being funded in part by Soros.
That's like saying a lot of people, that's like the president saying, a lot of people tell me I can do it by executive order.
The reason I even introduced that point, Steve, is though, so the president should measure his words because that misinformation is out there.
Right. So if all these things, if you add up these things, you know, the gunman was upset about the synagogue helping immigrants. The president is talking about, I mean, all the pieces are there. He certainly didn't squash the violence. You know, and when going back to George Soros, Maxine Waters received 2 bombs. Now, I understand why a lot of people don't like Maxine Waters, and I understand why the president wouldn't like Maxine Waters. But I wouldn't mention her at a rally the next day or the next week. He's talking about her again. This is a woman who was bombed.
First and foremost is personal responsibility. So to say is Donald Trump directly responsible for the shooting of the synagogue in Pittsburgh? No. Is he directly responsible for the mail bomber? No, he's not. Does his rhetoric allow for an environment that, you know, that this stuff is increasingly becoming more and more okay? Yeah, he does. And when you have him applaud a congressional candidate in Montana,
Montana,
in Montana, who for body slamming a reporter the right. day that the reporter was slain by and chopped up by the Saudis in their consulate in Turkey.
And by the way, never wrestle him. You understand that? Never. Any guy that can do a body slam, he's my kind.
Is repulsive, and I've never been a defender of his speech. I do talk about the toxicity of the environment he's creating, but I also think we have to consider free will and personal responsibility in this equation.
But I also think that I don't know if it's motivating or inspiring. Certainly emboldened by. I mean, when you have, as Scott alluded to, and what we're all talking about, these instances, and a woman who was killed by somebody, by a Nazi or KKK member, white nationalist or whatever, and the president says there are good people on both sides. So I think that there is that environment that breeds this.
I mean, I think the phrase I used last week, I'll stay with, he is fostering an atmosphere that lends to this, that lends itself to this. I think that's what he's doing.
And he thinks it works for him. There was the interview he did with Axios where they were challenging him and they're saying, you know, a reporter is going to get shot and killed in America, and a U.S. journalist is going to get shot and killed. And he was like, but this works for me.
What happens if all of a sudden someone gets shot? Someone shoots one of these reporters? There's got to be a party that's like, damn it, I'm scared that someone is going to take it.
Jim, it's my only form of fighting back. I couldn't be here if I did that.
It was kind of like a wink and a nod. He's like, yeah, we all know this is a game, but it works for me.
He thinks that it works for him. And I guess next Tuesday will be a really interesting thing to find out, or next Wednesday morning probably. We're going to find out the extent to which it does work for him.
Which way do you think that's going to go?
Well, you know, as I said before, I get out of the prediction business because I was so wrong about Trump.
You sure were, Eric Zorn. Very wrong. The gang went on to talk about the gubernatorial race. They talked about Jason Van Dyke. And we also spent a little time discussing what Walter Jacobson said. He is a regular editorialist, I guess you'd call it, a commentator here on WGN Radio, the great Walter Jacobson. And Walter takes the media on as being responsible for this toxic environment. Walter says we are to blame, too. I'm glad Walter's got that voice out there, and the gang reacted to that a little bit.
Halloween is over, but I've been having this terrible dream about an orange-headed monster chasing me. Then I realized I was watching CNN.
That sounds like late-stage Trumpitis.
I had another dream that evil people were controlling my brain and putting terrible thoughts in it.
Actually, that is CNN. And all of this is a classic case of politosis, high anxiety from too much politics.
Isn't there some sort of all-natural wonder drug that I can take?
Now there is. Now there's Eurelium Life 9000.
Eurelium. What's Eurelium?
Eurelium is a new proprietary wonder drug cooked up by an ethnically blended group of serious people in lab coats in New Jersey.
Well, I have achy aches.
We've got that covered.
And upset stomach.
It'll handle that.
Headaches, anxiety.
Yep.
Bleeding gums. My hair is falling out. I lost a toe at work. I have no idea where that is.
Yeah, well,
Thursday, I burped up a small frog. Tell me what that's all about.
Well, let me see here. It doesn't really...
I'm speaking in tongues.
Well, maybe a double dose, some rest.
I'll take Eurelium Hoagie if you have one.
Take Eurelium Life 9000 as a pill, capsule, liquid, gel cap, eye drop, nasal mist, ear burst, arm patch, chewable briquette, ointment, powder, suppository, or ask about our all-new, completely experimental home epidural kit.
And the Hoagie?
Yeah, sure, we'll throw one together.
And it's gluten-free, right?
You're a lot of work, aren't you?
Always, always, always follow label directions. Close cover before striking. NLMS ID number 23, Skidoo.
Thank you, Dom Petit. 11:35 on GN Radio. This is John Williams. It's me, John, talking. I'm not singing. Got here for us, Griff.
This is a band called Greta Van Fleet. That song was called When the Curtain Falls, off of their album Anthem of the Peaceful Army. That's what it's called.
Yeah, I knew that. You know, that sounds a lot like the music I used to listen to when I was in high school. I gotta tell you, that's not in my wheelhouse, but that was such a great approximation of my life in 1980 that I kind of like that.
I like the word approximation. And this is a divisive band, and that's a good word for, I think, why they're divisive. Because are they bringing anything new to the table, or are they just a retread of old ideas? This is a band that's been slowly rising. They're from Michigan, and they've been rising over the past year or so, and they're, like, selling out huge venues.
I can totally believe that.
Off
because
of the strength of about 1.5 albums right now. No, but truly, like, they're just the breakthrough band.
How old are the players? Because if you want to hear
really
that kind
young.
Of music, you'd normally got to go listen to guys my age. That's kind of nice that somebody else is going, no, we'll do that too.
They are very young. I don't know exactly how old.
What's the name of the band again?
Greta Van Fleet.
Yeah, I'm all about Greta Van Fleet. That's my new favorite band.
Here's why I wanted to play them on this episode of the Vibe Score, because we've been gone for about a month.
Yeah.
And in that time, Pitchfork came through and reviewed this new album from them called Anthem of the Peaceful Army. And the review went viral because it was so outrageously scathing. And it was really fun to read. I don't know if you guys saw this. They give it 1.6 out of 10. So they have their own rating system, much like we do.
Sure.
That'd be like giving it a 16, right?
Right, yeah, yeah.
And here, I'll just read a little bit of it. Greta Van Fleet sound like they did weed exactly once, called the cops, and tried to record a Led Zeppelin album before they arrested themselves. That's the first line.
Ouch.
That but is the first line.
I'm sorry. You don't even have to be really good at it. People pay money to go hear Led Zeppelin cover bands. If somebody else wants to go be a Led Zeppelin, you're not Led Zeppelin, but that's a sound. It would be like if somebody said, well, jazz was done in the 20s. I really don't think you should play the horn anymore. You don't get to do that.
I agree. I'm on board with you, John, because it's not like they are a cover band. They're taking the genre and they're creating new songs. I think that's difficult as anything. I mean, to pull a genre and to create new songs and to get a following like they have by doing that alone, I think that's really impressive.
What are you going to do? If you're going to do stadium rock from the 70s, it's going to sound a little like that. That's it.
Well, and in the review, and I'm not fully co-signing the review. I don't like this band very much, but I don't hate them. I don't have the ire for them that...
Sometimes it's fun to really hate a band, isn't it?
It was great fun. And Pitchfork has been very nice for the past few years. And it was great to see them back to their old ways, just absolutely roasting someone who, for no reason, it seems like. But they compared it to The Darkness. Do you remember that band? They had a song called I Believe in a Thing Called Love. That was a throwback to this same kind of rock. And they were explaining the ways that they like that song and they don't like what, and it's interesting distinctions, but
okay, well,
it's worth a read and then worth a listen to know what you're reading about.
Yeah, you're gonna have to play a little more of that for us in a minute. But in the meantime, having heard that Led Zeppelin cover band just now, on a scale of 1 to 100, Joe, what do you rate it? Go.
I give that song, I'll give it an 88. I really like their song, and it's probably their most popular one, Safari Song.
Yeah,
and that is just identical to Led Zeppelin. But again, I like the fact that they're trying to sound like Led Zeppelin but not playing their songs. I think no one's ever really done that.
So. I wonder what they would make of that assessment,
yeah,
though. They would probably take offense to the way
okay.
you guys are talking about.
Okay, yeah, that's true. I'm not saying shouldn't say they're trying to sound like them, but they do sound like
no,
them.
No, I think you're absolutely right, though. I think they would take offense, but I don't think you're wrong.
Yeah, right. You get to say whatever you want to say if that's
no,
what
and
it sounds
do.
Like.
No, and they do. It's an obvious attempt to sound like them, but I guess a reaction to what you said is, why not just listen to Led Zeppelin then? The songs are probably better. I mean,
I mean, because you only have so many Led Zeppelin songs. If you want new music, I mean, you know, we did this with Bruno Mars. You know, he stole this R&B sound and all of that. Well, I love those songs for several decades. I'd like to hear new versions of them.
Hmm. Okay, so Domity, score it.
I give it a 90.
Wow. I give it a 91.
I liked it a lot.
No, I can't.
Did they put Stairway to Hell on there or something else, you know?
Now they're just being the antonym of Led Zeppelin.
Exactly.
That would be so twisted. I was going to be a little more lenient, but seeing the high scores from across the board, no, it's 20.
You going to bring it down?
20?
Yeah. Oh, man.
You sounded like Nick Kroll when you said it, too, by the way.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm asking you guys now to score on a scale of 1 to 100 that Jimmy Kimmel thing we talked about earlier. the bit where they tell parents to steal the kids' candy and then video it. I'm giving that an 80 for just good old fun. Joe Brand, go.
I'm honestly surprised how much backlash that had.
A lot of hate going out there.
I was not expecting that whatsoever. I've always enjoyed them. The one thing I want to know is, do these people have the same opinions on the Christmas gift Spoofy does? Because that's
the Christmas gifts.
So they tell the kids, all right, you can open up one present before Christmas, and it's always a terrible gift. It's a spoon or a book, a book they'll never read. One time, a parent put an avocado in a giant gift bag, and the kid pulls out and goes, an avocado, thanks.
I remember the avocado one. That's classic.
So, I mean, that's the same type of joke, but you're seeing your children's genuine reaction to a gift, and you know, is that the same thing? I think the Halloween thing, I give it an 85. I still love it.
I'm with Joe. I give it an 85, man. These kids are soft today. I mean, life's going to take you candy sometime. Just, you know, you got to train them up early.
I don't love that that's where the conversation inevitably goes, but it is. Because usually when that is the tone that's being invoked, I'm on the other side. But with this one, I think I don't care enough. I don't really feel one side or the other enough. So that makes me just think, let them do it.
But here's the thing. Is it okay if the older brother or older sister does it then?
Yes. Well, because the older brother or older sister has. But you don't have the trust factor with the older brother or sister.
I get that.
They're not the lodestar that the mom or dad are. So maybe that's the difference. Although I've signed up because I think I'm a little bit like Doma T. I think the kids are getting soft out there. They need to learn to live with a little disappointment, shock, or dismay. It's going to come at the expense of their confidence in their parents. That's not great. But I think, you're not being a good parent if your kids can't, you've raised them for how many years now? Every single day? One day you play a little trick on them, okay, and suddenly that trust is shattered?
Right, we get it. How about this, though? Lying is wrong. Should you...
Why? Hold on.
What?
It is just like they are lying to their children. I mean, I don't know.
I wanted you guys to give us one TV show that we're all just going to kind of recommend here, something we're advocating for, because I was going to ask you guys to 1 to 100 rate The Haunting of Hill House, but I don't know that everybody's watched it. So I'm going to give you my show and my score of it. The Haunting of Hill House, I'm giving it a 90. It's not as scary as you might have heard, but it's scary enough. It's a fun, fun drama for 10 episodes. I'm giving Haunting of Hill House a 90. Griff, what are you liking these days?
American Vandal. It's the only show I care about. Most shows, Haunting of Hill House, for example, I watch 1 to 2 episodes of, and I think that was pretty good, but then I stop. I do that with every show. Every show that people rave about, and this is the exception. I watched it immediately. Season 2 is out on Netflix now. It's my favorite show by far.
Yeah. How about you, Joe Brand? What do you like him?
I'll echo. I watch sporadically of Haunting of Hill House, and I did like it a lot. The show I really like is Atypical on Netflix. I do give it an 89. The only thing I have against it, it's about this family that has an autistic son who's going through high school, and he's got a younger sister, and his younger sister is kind of the one that takes care of him in school, and he's got a really good relationship with his dad. I think it's a really good, informative, it's a funny show. He's a hilarious character. I mean, because of his, he just never has a sense of awareness with humor. And everything he says is hysterical because he just tells it how it is, and he's so blunt with everything. But I do think it kind of romanticizes the aspect of raising an autistic child. So I think they kind of take away from some of the hard issues on it, but they do a good job of bringing awareness of it. But, you know, the worst thing is he has a meltdown on a bus or something like that, and then that's it, and then they get over it. I think there's a lot of harder issues that could be hit, but again, then it's probably not as likable as of a show, because then it is very real, but I do definitely recommend Atypical.
You know, what you just said, you could almost say about The Good Doctor. It kind of maybe whitewashes some of the truth about being autistic, but it's also a fun show, and no awareness, no sense of humor, which is its own kind of funny on that show. So who's left? Dominator.
That was a thoughtful, philosophical debate. I don't even know how I can follow that up. I'm going to do... What do you guys think of, not Big Mouth, but adult cartoons?
1 to 100?
1 to 100 adult cartoons.
I'll
I know a
first.
Lot of people who are over
seven.
Those.
Seven.
Seven?
Yeah.
You one of those?
I am. I am. Griff, go.
It really depends on the show, but generally I'd go 60. Like I said about Big Mouth, I ended up watching it and loving it, but I was not interested just based on how it looked at first.
Yeah.
That's usually how I come down.
What do you mean, Joe?
Yeah. What do you, Joe?
Trying to average it out with all the cartoon adult shows I've watched, I'll go with 80. I mean, I'm a big fan of Family Guy.
Right,
Simpsons,
and Big Mouth
South
is
Park.
Is co-created by a Family Guy writer.
So yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just, I think they're a good, witty humor. I mean, my favorite thing about South Park is how they simplify all the problems in the world and make, you know, the things that look so terrible so easy.
Yeah.
It's just... That's what I enjoy, that type of humor. I'll go with 80.
I give them a 90. When they're good, they're great because they take the sting out of things and get you over that. What'd you call it, John? That Trump-itis?
Yeah.
They give you some of that, though, but they take the sting out of it that we see too often in political discourse. I like it.
So that show that you really like is called Big Mouth, right?
Called Big Mouth.
You know, one other thing I was going to recommend, guys, or ask you to score, 1 to 100, the Golden State Warriors.
How about 116?
You know, it's so much fun to watch somebody do anything as well as they do what they do. And they're still doing it. I watched them play the Bulls. I watched them play the Timberwolves. I watched a few of their games this year. And I don't know what the world is saying about them, if they're as good or going to be as good. But I'll tell you what, that night that they lit up the Bulls putting up 92 in the first half, that was a thing of beauty. And I'm rooting for the Bulls.
What did Klay Thompson do in that game?
He broke
14 three-pointers.
The NBA record for most threes that was set by Steph at 13. He had 14. He had 10 in the first half. He had 14 three-pointers, and he didn't play a full quarter of the game.
I saw the numbers the next day. It's stupid to talk about it if I haven't looked it up, but it was like... 50 points in 26 minutes.
Yeah, right.
I couldn't believe what I was reading. I thought it was a typo.
I think the Bulls outscored them something like 74-56 in the second half, and they still lost by like 20 points.
Yeah, it was so one-sided. And it was a little bit that way last night where the Timberwolves were actually playing even with them. It was nice to see Jimmy Butler out there. And then in the second half, they went, we'll be the Golden State Warriors now, and it's a completely different game.
Right.
They are so much better than everyone.
They just have that total control, and they know their team so well and their teammates and what they're capable of
where
doing.
Where they're going to be.
Exactly. And they've played so many games together, not just through the regular seasons, but all these deep playoff runs. They know everyone's best attributes. And I mean, the way they space out the court and find the open looks. And when you have sharp shooters, more than just one, more than just two, more than just three, you're able to control a ball game like that.
The fun thing is how many good shots they pass up. Just whipping that ball around like they're taking on the Washington Generals. They're just zipping the ball around, and then one of them goes, all right, I'll score. But it's very unselfish play, too, and for a bunch of A-type scorers, it's just a thing of beauty. Them Golden State Warriors. It's 11:49. This is WGN. I know what you're thinking. Gee, John, thanks for all this information and entertainment. That's really been good, but why haven't you talked about Alec Baldwin? Okay, just for a minute, we'll catch you up on this story. Alec Baldwin, you've probably heard, has been arrested and charged with assault and harassment after allegedly hitting another man in the face during a dispute over a parking spot in New York City. I'm reading from the Chicago Tribune's website. This is an Associated Press story. They now say that Alec Baldwin is denying that he's punched anyone over that. And he says this is just all clickbait. You know, you put Alec Baldwin out there. People love to hate me. They click on the story, and then the website gets more hits, but it's nothing. It's nothing. Baldwin says that it's become sport to tag people with as many negative charges for the purpose of clickbait entertainment. There's a couple of things about this story, though. So he says it didn't happen anyway. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. I don't know. Who cares? Baldwin, 60, told police that a family member was holding the parking spot in front of his Manhattan home when a man driving a Saab station wagon pulled up and took it. The driver of the station wagon told police that Baldwin hit him with his hand. He wasn't sure if it was a punch or a slap, but he had a sore jaw and some redness in his neck area and was taken to the hospital. Anytime a celebrity slaps you, you go immediately to the hospital because that'll increase the payout for you down the road. Maybe he was really injured, right? But here's my question. Is it okay for, say you've got a parking spot that is in front of your place, but you're not there yet? So you call your family member, friend, and say, hey, there's a spot in front of my place. Hold it for me, and then I'll pull up and take it. Well, if you're holding it with a car, I guess that's okay. But what if you're just kind of in a...
Well, this is the classic Chicago question of dibs, right?
Isn't it? Kind of what it is. Yeah. Although this isn't a chair, you know, during the snow season. This sounds like somebody was just kind of in a linebacker's crouch, you know, just like in a stance going, all right, I got this. This is Baldwin's spot. I'm holding this for him. You don't get to do that.
This is Alec Baldwin. Did you see 30 Rock? You like that show? This is for him.
I know. Really, you're going to take this? This is a 30 Rock. He's a star. You can't take his spot. Yes, you can. You cannot hold. I'm not even crazy about you idling in your car and then pulling out while you're holding it for the guy.
Did you see It's Complicated?
Is that what you're going to do?
He was so good.
He
deserves the spot.
That is my problem with a few stars, and Alec Baldwin may be the best of them. I so enjoy the body of his work. I hate it when his personal behavior challenges my affection for him.
All the time. Yeah, he seems like a jerk.
But even on the talk shows, a lot of times, he's absolutely charming and funny. And you get this. You get the feeling that he knows he's a jerk, but he can't help himself. That he's...
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe he can't help himself is...
Anybody can turn it on for 10 minutes. I just think he's probably a jerk.
Who's really funny and pleasant to watch on sitcoms.
It's like if he had one of these incidents. He has them all the time.
Yeah, well, you know what they're doing
you
now.
You meet a jerk in the morning, it's a bad day. You meet jerks all day, you're the jerk, right? That's
you know what they're doing? They're digging up the audio of that call he made to his daughter when she was 12 or 11 and was going through a divorce. That is the worst thing you will ever hear. It's 11:56. He said it didn't happen. Stay tuned.